If they want to continue to go the route of taking over Syria, they can do that. But they cannot do it with chemical weapons. They can't do it assaulting their people. And we're not going to fall for it. If there are chemical weapons that are used, we know exactly who's going to use them. And this is the exact same playbook that Russia and Iran and Assad have used every time.
Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to the Liberty Report. With me today is Daniel McAdams, our co-host. Daniel, good to see you this morning.
How are you this morning, Dr. Paul?
I am doing very well, and today I want to follow up, and we've talked about Syria before, and there's a battle brewing over there. It looks like it might be a conclusive battle. That maybe Syria will be returned to the Syrians, for all we know. It's coming to an end. But before we get started, I wanted you to just make a comment about our little clip this morning, because in a way it's connected to Syria, but it's something that...
Yeah. Well, that's Nikki Haley.
Nikki had to say. So she is not exactly on our side of the foreign policy issue.
No, it's classic Nikki, and you know she took off on what President Trump's tweeted on Monday, warning Syria against retaking. But you know, if you listen to this clip, it's really pretty incoherent. She's saying, if the Syrian government wants to take back Syrian territory, well, I guess. You know, that's okay, you know, I mean, we can't stop them, but they better not use chemicals. And if chemicals are used, we know exactly who has used them. You know, she's a psychic, as Caitlin Johnstone, who spoke at our conference, wrote yesterday. She's a clairvoyant. She knows beforehand. So, you know, it's this whole thing opening the door for yet another round of U.S. strikes. You know, against Syria.
But, you know, half of that's probably very true. If there is one, she'll probably know exactly who pulled the false flag. Not that that's what her reaction will be, but if there is one, that she will know. But no, in the last few days, a few weeks, there's been a lot of talk about the supposedly could be the last major battle for Syria to return Syria to the Syrian government. And, of course, on the side of Assad are the Russians and Iran, and they're lining up. But it looks like the last haven, that last holdout for the al-Qaeda and ISIS is in Idlib. And there's thousands of people there, and they're not laughing at a few stragglers. They have a lot of people there willing to fight to the end, and the bombing has already started. The Americans have dropped some bombs.
The Russians have been bombing.
The Israelis have been bombing. So they're softening up their targets, but it's still, I think, even the side that is determined, and they will put Idlib back into the fold under Assad. But I think there's some people still hoping maybe some sense can come to these people, and maybe they can build some areas where the people who say, hey, I don't want to be annihilated, and let them go or something like that, instead of destroying the city like another city was once destroyed by some of our bombs.
Yeah. No, and I think they've worked on building humanitarian corridors like they did in Douma and in Ghouta beforehand. But the issue is, this is the last stronghold, and you mentioned that it's held by al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda primarily, the Nusra Front, and also another terrorist group out of Turkey. The two of them pretty much control Idlib. And it's not us saying it. It's not the conspiracy theorists saying it. It's not the Russians or the Iranians saying it. It's actually President Trump's own envoy, as you wrote in your weekly column, Brett McGurk, the president's special envoy for the worldwide global coalition against ISIS, said last year that this area is a real problem for us, because this is the biggest al-Qaeda stronghold since 9/11. So the two, if you look at what he says and what's happening now, that doesn't make sense. If it's the strongest al-Qaeda foothold since 9/11, why is the U.S. demanding that Russia and Syria not take care of this of the issue?
Yeah, and I think most people assume that this is going to be concluded one way or the other, because they're actually lining up, you know, and planning the future. for Syria under the new circumstance. It reminds me of Bretton Woods. About a year before the war was over, they were sitting up in Bretton Woods in New Hampshire planning the new monetary order. Well, in a way, there's some planning already, too. There's one somewhat related to the United Nations, and that is the Russians, the Turks, and the Iranians are getting together, and they're making their plans. And, of course, that'll be touch and go, too, because I think Russia is not looking to have an all-out battle with Israel. So I imagine they're thinking about trying to pacify the Iranians and have them move back. But anyway, the Russians and the Turks and the Iranians are talking about this and what may come of it. What kind of reforms there will be. But we also have other talks, and that's the U.S. government along with Israel talking with Saudi Arabia, the usual suspects. But ultimately, though, those talks are probably going to be important, but, it's the victors who write the rules anyway. So I don't think it's the final word, but I think this is an indication that this thing is going to wind on. I think 7 years is enough. So often when these vicious wars end, it's just when people finally get tired of it. It's just too bad the American people haven't got tired of financing and being involved in Afghanistan. That's been going on a lot longer. But this one looks like it's going to wind down, and we should know about this soon. But, as the Haley's comments are, they're looking at it for a false flag. I think that's a big deal. And we've talked about that already, about that and who gets blamed for it. But, with all this talk, you would think it would become insignificant. Everybody's blaming each other already about who's going to be gassing whom. And, of course, Trump's been pretty strong on this, way over the top. And I think he was the one that he was accused of being pretty hard on what he should do with Assad, last spring, in the 17, because he didn't think it through. He said, we got to get rid of this guy. But he was just, following up with the Democrats. This is a very bipartisan function. All this pretense that the world depends on who wins between the Republicans and Democrats and who gets appointed to the Supreme Court, it doesn't even enter the picture when you think about ruling the world. The deep state is very, very powerful and influential in the Democrat and the Republican Party. And that's why I think, that one way or the other, there will be agreement, on so much of this, especially the settlement, because certainly, the alignments aren't going to, be different than what, the way it is now. And Trump is aware of that. He speaks out strongly, but it's still something that the best thing could happen is there is no gassing. If there is, the Russians are actually, they're probably doing a smart thing. They say, oh, yeah, they're preparing. We've seen them hauling in some chlorine bottles and this sort of thing, try to neutralize this because they would be victimized by this. And it remains to be seen on exactly how this evolves.
And speaking about Trump, I'll take the Trump of 2013 when he tweeted out, these rebels in Syria are all a bunch of jihadists. Why are we getting involved on these people's side? What are we doing there? We shouldn't be in there at all. So I'll take that one. But you also mentioned the U.S. kind of speak with crocodile tears in its eyes about humanitarian concerns. And that's how President Trump framed his tweet on Monday night about humanitarian crisis is coming for Idlib. And, of course, that is a concern. Unfortunately, civilians do die in wars and increasingly so. But, it was a different story in places like Mosul and Raqqa, where the U.S. came in and completely obliterated these cities completely. And here's an Amnesty report that actually just came out in July of 2018 on the 17th. It's talking about the U.S.-led coalition is deeply in denial about civilian casualties in Raqqa. The U.S. claimed, 23 people were killed by our bombs in Raqqa. This is from the Amnesty report, the only coalition, U.S. coalition partner on the ground was the Kurdish SDF. And they said coalition mistakes and unsuccessful airstrikes have resulted in huge human and material losses on the ground. We actually have a picture here, and let our audience judge for themselves whether it looks like only 23 civilians were killed in Raqqa. This is literally annihilated from the face of the earth after U.S. bombing last year, Raqqa, completely destroyed, nothing left of it. But we claim only 23 people killed, and now we're warning Assad not to kill civilians in Idlib. So it's the hypocrisy there is a little bit thick.
Yes, and you know, it's pretty evident that the two parties do come together. I mean, and they distort and distract. Because right now, how many people in this country do you think have any idea that we might have been sympathetic and helpful to Al-Qaeda?
Yeah.
Nobody would believe that.
Because it's so crazy, but
they,
it's true.
They wouldn't believe it. Why should they? It's so preposterous, nobody would believe it. But it's also never reported. But think of Russiagate. That's been reported a few times, and that's, you know, fits the purpose of the two political parties. So that's ongoing. Who's going to blame whom? Who talked to the Russians more? And so, but this whole thing that the Russiagate is something that exists. People aren't aware of this, and this is the big problem because it is hard to believe. Now, sometimes the people that get involved also that they have been deceptive, but less so now are the white helmets. Now, to your knowledge, have the white helmets moved back in? Are they being used in this episode, do you think?
Well, the U.S. and the U.K. have already evacuated some of them from the south. Remember when they took over the southwest, they evacuated them. Apparently, the white helmets are there. I saw a couple of pictures yesterday of them diligently rescuing people. cameras at hand, ready to go. But, of course, they're the ones that have been documenting these so-called gas attacks, which we very, very strongly suspect were false flags.
Yeah, but most Americans, if they knew about them, it would sound good. You know,
yeah.
they were to go in there and help. But immediately when somebody got hurt, they ran very quickly. I mean, they weren't helping anybody except the military operation, and it wasn't on the side of the American people.
Yeah, well, why would they run when Al-Qaeda is defeated, even if they're not allied? And also, if they're these wonderful humanitarian, selfless volunteers, why does the U.S. government give them $100 million and the U.K. government give them millions of dollars? So it's a farce, I think. But you mentioned the bipartisan aspect of this whole thing, and I think that's the most sickening part.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you remember this, Dr. Paul, back in April, when actually the first time, in April 17, when President Trump first bombed Syria, what did the great liberal CNN, Fareed Zakaria, Donald Trump just became president tonight. You know, they couldn't even control themselves. They were so thrilled that he was finally bombing something. You know, it says a lot.
You know, Syria was involved, you know, with the spring revolutions, and I'm sure there were people and still are some people that are disgruntled and they don't think that Assad is the greatest.
Yeah.
But it shows that he probably has more support than anybody else. But sometimes when I'm in a certain mood, I stop and think, what would it have been like if we would have never lifted a finger to deal with Syria, you know, this current Syria? Where would it be? There would still be some disgruntled people, and you'd still have Israel involved. You'd still have the Kurds involved. But where would it be? Would it ever have gotten this bad? I happen to think that if we'd have been completely out of there, there probably would have been some social disorder, but I don't think it would have ever ended up into a social revolution and the Assad family destroyed forever. And I just don't believe that happened. It looks to me that in these last 7 years, the perpetuation, it was mainly our interference over there. Because as far as legitimacy goes, if you think about, you know, some type of international law, that a country does have a right to protect its sovereignty. It has a right to have, treaties and understanding with other countries. And certainly nobody claimed that it was illegal for Russia to have a base in Syria. And they don't really challenge the legality of Russia being helpful to Syria. So it seems to me like this just would have, you know, not happened much. A lot of lives probably would have been sold, saved, and who knows how it came. But that's pure speculation and not much I can do about it.
You know, someone asked President Putin, I think last year, a couple of years ago, about their base in Syria. And he told the reporter, why don't you go look at a map with all the U.S. bases outside of the U.S., and then take a look at all the Russian bases outside of Russia, and then let's get back and talk about it.
Yeah, that's a good one.
But you mentioned this, and this is, you know, you don't have to love Assad or be an Assadist, as some of the people claim, to notice that people do vote with their feet. People move back into Aleppo, as you mentioned this week. Once Assad took back over, they moved back into Ghouta. They moved back to these areas. So if he was just involved in killing his people, why would you move back for that? But a couple of points I wanted to make about Idlib, if I can, just for a second. First of all, these people, U.S. government, Trump and others, are demanding that Assad not liberate Idlib from its control of al-Qaeda. If they're really concerned about the humanitarian situation, why is there not a single voice, Nikki Haley, Bolton, Noble, why isn't there a single voice telling these people that are holding the province, look, just give up, you know, surrender, put down your weapons, avoid the battle. No one says that. That's something interesting. The second point is that Brett McGurk, who we talked about, who's Trump's special envoy, we know that it's run by al-Qaeda. He told us this. So if we don't want the Russians and Syrians to deal with the al-Qaeda, is the U.S., is President Trump ready to take these al-Qaeda fighters as refugees in the U.S.? Because the problem is, this is how interventionism comes back to bite. This is the unintended consequences of interventionism. The U.S. and its allies sponsored thousands of foreign fighters to go into Syria to overthrow the government. They were Uyghurs from China. They were people from Qatar. There are people from Jordan, all over the world, who came there to fight jihad, sponsored by Saudi, sponsored by U.S. So now that they're there, all of these foreign nationalities fighting in Idlib, none of the countries want to take them back. The Chinese don't want 20,000 crazed, head-chopping Uyghurs to come back. The U.S. wouldn't be happy to have them. Jordan doesn't want them back. So this is when you plan a war like this, these are the consequences. The real problem with Idlib is that nobody knows what to do with these people.
Yeah, and we have trouble making sense out of it all. But wouldn't it be possible to make sense of it by looking at the appointments, you know, whether it's Pompeo or Haley or Bolton and all this. They're all neocons, and they're there. And at times, they might, you know, go along with something Trump suggests and say, well, you know, maybe they're not in charge. But when you look at it in the positions they have, how can you come to any other conclusion, you know, than the fact that, you know, these are the people in charge of our foreign policy, and even though there may be a day that we, you know, become slightly hopeful, if we're realistic, we have to say, well, the policy can't possibly change, and therefore we're going to remain in a dangerous situation. But, you know, our opposition, even from, you know, conservatives, they'll say, oh, yeah, but you guys are naive. You got to be strong. This will be tough. A guy like Trump is going to protect us and keep us safe and secure, and there's no risk in this. But they won't say, and besides, you know, it provides a lot of jobs for a lot of people building weapons, which occasionally slips out on a few of people's opinions.
Yeah. Actually, I just noticed the Mises Institute has a great article up about how Washington is so rich, you know, and that's part of it. But I would just conclude by saying I don't usually put a lot of stake in unnamed senior administration officials. But in this one case, I'm going to make an exception. David Ignatius, who's considered, you know, the errand boy for the CIA, but he had a piece recently in the Washington Post, and he quoted a senior U.S. administration official saying, quote, right now our job is to create quagmires for the Russians and Syrian governments until we get what we want. And I tend to believe that. I think that's our strategy. Everything has failed, so what we're going to do now is just simply mess things up as much as we can until we get what we want. So unfortunately, that if you're looking for a U.S. grand strategy, unfortunately, that is at this point. I would just remind our viewers to please subscribe to the channel and to have your friends subscribe. Our subscriber base is growing, and we're happy to have that happen. If you want to look at some articles related to the things we talk about, RonPaulInstitute.org, RonPaulLibertyReport.com, which tends more toward economic arguments. Ron Paul Institute tends more toward foreign policy and civil liberties. There's plenty of backing material, plenty to read to get yourself educated. And thanks again for joining us, Dr. Paul.
And Daniel, you make a good point about the quagmire. If it's their goal, they're doing a very good job. If it's not their goal, but can tolerate it, they're doing a very good job. And, you know, that is a natural result of interventionism, you know, the blowback, the expensive, and all the complications. And we don't know exactly what's going to come of this last battle. I think it's going to smolder a while, but there could be a deliberate setup for quagmire, but it's not going to be resolved easily, and there's going to be those problems. But I keep thinking that even with a, let's say, a total victory in getting rid of our allies in Idlib, and we get rid of Al-Qaeda and ISIS, there's always going to be people resentful, whether it's for economic reasons or for military reasons, against the United States for our interference and our bullying the world around and throwing our weight around. So that is always going to be a problem. And therefore, if you're looking for a quagmire, just look at our foreign policy. Look at just, you know, since 9/11, 2001, those years have been really, really tough. And yet people say, yeah, but we're safe. And a lot of them still argue with me. They say, yes, we're safe. We had to give up a little bit of our liberties, but we're still safe. Well, we're not exactly safe. We're getting poorer. And we have a policy here that can get out of control. And I suspect it's not going to be this battle over Idlib that's going to get totally out of control, but it potentially could. You know, you just don't know what would happen. So it makes the point for looking at, studying, and understanding what non-intervention is all about. It's not isolationism. It's working and talking and trading with the world and working with diplomacy rather than just saying, you do it our way and we'll give you a lot of money. If you don't do it our way, you're going to have a lot of bombs thrown at you. So there's a better system. And I think that traditionally there have been many in America that have talked about this, and that we just have to get to people who are interested in peace and prosperity to know what that is, what that comes from. And you have to have a philosophy on foreign policy and domestic economic policy in order to achieve it. But I cannot believe for a minute that if you poll the people of America and find out, do you think it's a good idea to work toward peace and prosperity? I would say most people would say, yes, that's a good idea. They have to be convinced, though, the road to peace and prosperity comes from the recognition of what liberty is all about. I want to thank everybody for tuning in today to the Liberty Report. Please come back soon.